Welcome, dear listener, to episode 14 of Dirty Thoughts, Let's Talk. If you came for the dirty thoughts that make you tingle down there, you might be in the wrong place. However, if you came to find out how to manage those dirty thoughts keeping you from being the best possible version of yourself and would like to have some fun while doing it, then you are indeed in the right place. I'm your host and founder of The Clean Thinkers, Mike Marcella, and I'd like to thank you for tuning into our weekly podcast. I genuinely appreciate you coming along in this journey with me and the rest of the Clean Thinkers community. Now, if you're one of our long-term dear listeners, you're probably wondering why we didn't have an episode last week. It's the first time that we've missed an episode in our weekly format since we started. And of course, we posted about it on social media, but you know, not everyone is keeping tabs on whatever useless stuff we're posting on there. And I know for my part that I probably wouldn't even be on the goddamn garbage of social media if it weren't for the Clean Thinkers, but sadly I need to be. So anyway, I get it if you weren't informed. But with my family's recent move from Alpine to downtown San Diego, I just wasn't able to quite get the studio set up quickly enough to record an episode up to the quality I expect for the Dirty Thoughts Let's Talk podcast. The new studio, big air quotes there, that I'm recording in now, well, it's in the closet of my son's room, which doubles as the guest room when he's not with us. And while it is a nice, quiet place to record, which is kind of hard to find in the city, the acoustics leave a lot to be desired. So I needed to get some soundproofing material up on the walls, which took some time. And it's still not completely covered. There's some bare spots and, you know, there's the door and all this, and it was a sliding door, so I couldn't put the soundproofing material on that. So I can't say for sure if sound quality is going to be perfect, so bear with me if not, because this is a work in progress, but hopefully it doesn't sound like too much shit, but please let me know. But even if we did set aside the technical requirements, moves are pretty hectic, so I really wasn't in an ideal state anyway to mentally sit down and record for 40 plus minutes and then also deliver the content to the level of quality I expect. And sure, that level of quality may be depressingly low, but it's a goddamn level and I expect to hit it nonetheless. And so, in order to continue hitting that despicably low quality bar I've set for the show, and perhaps even raise it a little, we are going to, moving forward, change the format of the Dirty Thoughts Let's Talk podcast. Specifically, we're going to change the frequency of episode releases to every other week from the weekly releases that we've been doing thus far. This is not a decision I came to lightly, but I've reached a point where preparing the podcast, recording it, editing it, and promoting it has pretty much become a full-time job of its own, and it has been taking a substantial amount of time away from my other duties to the Clean Thinkers, which, you know, I would like to grow. Not to mention, it also has been taking time away from my most important jobs, which is being the best parent and partner that I can be. So, for the foreseeable future, we will be releasing episodes every other week moving forward. So, I hope that's okay with all of you dear listeners out there. If not, well, too fucking bad, I suppose. And now, having said that, this is the perfect time to go give that bad review you've been contemplating for a while. So, go ahead, tell everybody how much of an asshole I am. And now, with all that out of the way, thank you for sticking around. I hope you came back after our little hiatus. Let's go ahead and get after this week's episode. And I'm going to spare you any sales pitches since I just spent the entire opening of the episode whining about how I need more time and blah, blah, blah. So even though it's been a couple of weeks, I hope everyone remembers what we were talking about last week. If not, in our last episode, we covered part one of religion, which is one of the most powerful subjective influences on our thinking. It is so powerful, in fact, that we couldn't cover the entire subject in a single episode. So we broke it into two parts. In part one, we introduce the topic by asking the question, do we know why we're religious in the first place? And then discussed many of the reasons why we're religious, both the inborn reasons or the genetic ones, and those that are environmental or learned over time. We then discussed the reasons we humans developed religions to begin with, many of which relate back to comfort, such as the comfort we get from belonging to a like-minded group we can relate with, and the comfort of having difficult questions answered, like what happens after we die, where do we come from, why we're here, all of them. And we then talked about how all of our other influences and enablers contribute to our adoption of and reliance on religion. And yes, pretty much all of them are involved in one way or another. Now, I won't go into gory detail since we already did during the episode in question, but they all have the potential to be involved. That's what's important. And then after that, we started talking about the bad stuff, specifically the ways that religion can act as a negative influence on our thinking. More specifically yet, we talked about the negatives that can come about when we forget religion's essential subjectivity and begin to treat it as something that is objective. Like when we push our subjective views onto others and expect them to not only accept our beliefs, but modify their own behavior and their views to accommodate our beliefs. Ridiculous, yes, but that's what we do. And some of these things, they might be small and relatively innocuous in the grand scheme of things, such as the argument as to whether the phrase "under God" should remain in the Pledge of Allegiance. Remember, we talked about that one. Or the annual made-up war on Christmas, right? We talked about that one too. Both of these are annoying, sure, but they aren't resulting in any real detriments except for being a pain in everyone's ass who doesn't want to have anything to do with it. And that's pretty much where we left off, with the promise that we would begin talking about examples that do have real detriments and that are gross overreaches of one's subjective beliefs. Well, we're about to fulfill that promise, and I hope you heeded my advice and grabbed those pearls because, dear listener, we are going to talk about capital A, abortion. And I recognize that for some of you, this is the last time you'll be joining us after today's discussion. So I want to thank you for sticking it out as long as you did. We at the Clean Thinkers recognize we're an acquired taste and not for everyone, like an exceptionally stinky and funky cheese. So thanks again for sticking around for as long as you did. Let's move on and go ahead and get into it. And to begin the meat of our discussion, I'll just go ahead and lay it out there for you. The Clean Thinkers' contention is that a pro-choice stance is the only truly objective one and is the only one that does not necessitate treatment of one's subjective views as objective fact, which again does not serve the holder of those beliefs or anyone else for that matter. Now, of course, this is a very contentious topic with passionate viewpoints on either side. So we're going to speak in depth about why only the pro-choice viewpoint is objective. Because if we can recognize the essential subjectivity of the pro-life viewpoint for an emotionally charged topic such as this, then we can do it for just about anything else. And that will go a long way towards helping us manage our influences across the board throughout our entire lives. And so our discussion about abortion is going to focus on a major point of contention in the debate, which is the morality of abortion. Because the argument from the pro-life side follows a morality-based logical path that goes something like this. Abortion is a form of murder, and since murder is immoral and illegal, abortion should be as well. Well, now I see how this might sound perfectly reasonable if one's influences and enablers desired it to be so, but there are two major flaws in this logic. The first flaw is the assumption that our individual morals have universal jurisdiction over others. And not even universal jurisdiction, but any fucking jurisdiction for that matter. They are our individual morals and based wholly on subjective factors. Because they themselves are subjective and depend on multiple factors, such as time period, culture, and one's individual religious affiliation. For example, just simply consider a woman walking alone at night. A century ago, this would have been widely viewed as immoral and completely wrong. But outside of some developing countries with theocratic tendencies, that's really no longer the case today. And by the way, before we move on, given the current subject matter, it's probably worth considering, right, just how many of these morally justified behavioral decrees are applicable to women only. Now, there are obviously numerous other factors at play in the topic of abortion outside of its specificity towards women, but this particular factor should not be ignored, okay? Because a lot of these things, they were established by white men or just men in general to say women can't do this, women can't do that, blah, blah, blah. And they have a religious justification for it. It's pretty messed up, but just lots of them are just like that. But anyway, the overall point of this first flaw is that morals are subjective, and they are specific to the individual's culture, and the individual's time period. The second flaw is another example of moral misappropriation, and in this case, it's the incorrect, that is right, incorrect assumption that laws are based on morals, and that murder is therefore illegal due to its immorality. Murder is not illegal because it's considered immoral. It is illegal because if we ran around killing one another, it would not be conducive to order or human progress, not because of any associated morals. You don't agree with that? Okay, let's consider speed limits and texting laws. These laws do not exist because Moses proclaimed, "Thou shalt not drive like an asshole," on the Mount, do they? No. They're not derived from some biblical interpretation of morals, are they? There wasn't any fucking driving, there wasn't any texting, there wasn't speed limits in biblical times. So of course they're not derived based on morals. They are instead there to keep people safe from reckless and or distracted drivers. Same deal with drug laws. Sure, there are some Bible passages that warn about substance use, but if it were a moral issue, then substances in general would be banned, not just the ones we've deemed most destructive, or more accurately, seriously, the ones with insufficient lobbying power. But if it were truly based on the immorality of substances, then we need to apply that blanket across the board. Tobacco, caffeine, nicotine, alcohol, etc. That all has to be outlawed as well, so you can't say that drugs are based on morals either, okay? To further illustrate the flaw in the morality argument, let's consider all of the other biblical morality decrees that are not implemented into law today, because we cannot in good faith base some laws on morals and not others, right? If there's no difference, then we have to say that every law came from morals. If you want to say that abortion is immoral because murder is immoral and that is why murder is illegal, then we have to apply it to everything if we want to be fair. Don't we want to be fair and righteous? Isn't that kind of the whole deal, the religious thing? So to see what that might look like, if we ubiquitously apply biblical morals to the law, as suggested by the argument, then I would say that we are all headed for the hoosegow in somewhere just a bit toastier down the road. Liars? Oh, that's in there. Well, bye-bye every politician ever. Maybe there is something to this. But before we get excited, let's not forget slander is in there too, courtesy of Mark. So perhaps we should delete all of those not-so-nice social media comments and online reviews just to be safe. Oof, drunkards, you know it, so you better put down that shitty hard seltzer. Of course, we could go on and on and on, but I trust you've gotten the point, right? And also, even if you haven't gotten the point, I don't want to keep going on and on because I don't want to encourage any additional evil thoughts beyond those you're already likely having about me because, yep, those are in there too. You have evil thoughts, you go to hell. See ya! Now, certainly, evil thoughts are a little bit difficult to prosecute, but then again, so was witchcraft. And that was all the way back in the 1600s, we made that work just fine, because we humans, if nothing else, we are fucking resourceful, aren't we? Anywho, what I'm trying to say is that if we compare all the moral decrees, the rules, and the regulations from the religious texts used by the Abrahamic religions against the rules and regulations implemented in Western society, we see a very, very large disconnect. Said disconnect is that a substantial portion of those moral decrees, rules, and regulations are not part of our current system of laws, making it abundantly clear that today's laws are not based on a religious interpretation of morality. To further illustrate, look at China, the preferred offshoring locale lusted after, by most greedy, and government-subsidized U.S. corporations. Almost 70% of the Chinese nation is agnostic, atheist, or practices a folk religion with a government that itself is strictly non-religious. Yet, murder, okay, if it's based on morality, they should just be killing each other left and right. But it's still illegal in godless China, with a murder rate in godless China that's around 1/10 the rate of the U.S., a country which has a moral and religious majority, if you will. And of course, China is almost certainly cooking their books. Sure, they are. They are wont to do that. That is what they do. But even if we doubled their bullshit murder rate, doubled it, okay? I can't believe they're cutting it in half. I could imagine that they would cook their books a little bit, but cut it in half, that even seems a bit extreme for them. Even if we doubled it, we here in the morally superior good old US of A still kill each other about 5 times more frequently, okay? Even if you double it. God bless America, am I right? And so, dear listener, what I'm getting at in my normal roundabout, long-winded sort of way is that for the most part, the vast majority of we humans don't need a religious text to tell us not to kill one another. If that were the case, our species likely wouldn't have survived the millions of years we existed before someone thought up the idea of religions. Because, dear listener, religions were indeed an idea, and they were made up by us. And they were made up not all that long ago on the timeline of human history. And so interpreting the illegality of murder as a function of morality is a subjective interpretation of the individual, just as our views on the morality of abortion are the subjective interpretation of the individual. They are our own views and no one else's. Now, does that mean we need to love the fact that abortions happen? No, we don't have to go celebrate it. We don't have to be happy about it. Nobody's happy about it, I hope. But that still doesn't make it our business if somebody else does it, unless the only time that it can ever be our business is when we are contemplating having our own individual abortion. And for me, I was not equipped with the tools to do such a thing. So for me, it's none of my fucking business. That's why I don't even like talking about it, because it frustrates me, because I am a guy. I have no say in this conversation, but I'm talking about it to all the people that think they fucking do that don't have a say, okay? And this is all very important, okay? It's important to clean thinkers. It's important to society as a whole, but it's important because forgetting the subjective nature of our own morals in the case of the abortion issue is bad news for a number of reasons. One of those reasons applies to us, the individual, because we are creating conflict in our own mind and potentially our lives by worrying about the actions of others and whether or not they align with our own fucking preferences. We are spending mental and emotional energy on something outside of ourselves that is, again, none of our concern. It's not even a little bit of our concern. It is not even the slightest iota, fucking tiny subatomic particle bit of our goddamn concern. What value can we reasonably expect to garner for us or those to whom we're responsible by worrying about the actions of complete fucking strangers, or even if our neighbor, or whoever it is? What value can we get out of this? What? Another reason this is bad news is for the woman who is considering getting an abortion. Now, I don't like to speak for other people, but in most cases, I think we can be fairly confident that she is not thrilled to be in the situation she is in. And then, here come the pro-life folks who make a difficult situation 10,000 times more fucking difficult by inserting themselves where they have no business being. And you know what? Guess what? Even if she were super excited to be having an abortion, just can't wait to fucking do it and can't wait to have more, that's still none of our business. And she'd be clearly amongst a very small minority, but no matter what, still none of our business. And even if she was amongst that group that just loves having abortions and loves killing fetus, I don't know. If we're going to start justifying actions against an entire group based on the actions of a few, then I think we should go ahead and do away with altar boys so we can protect them from predatory priests and just get rid of church youth groups in general to protect them from creepy counselors, because they are all creepy, okay? Now I can go on, and I can go on, and I can go on where we can take the actions of a few and arbitrarily apply it to a group and extrapolate it out. We don't want to do that though, right? Because that's being prejudiced. But no matter what, even if every woman in the world who had an abortion was fucking thrilled about it, still none of our business. We don't have a say in it, okay? Now, what I want to do is I want to take this argument a little further, and I want to consider the situation where a woman ends up being shamed into having the baby because there are a host of issues that the child now that we so desperately wanted to save, we so desperately wanted them to be born, well, this child has a host of issues that then faces in their life that we placed so much value upon. For instance, a growing body of knowledge indicates that troublesome and stressful pregnancies set up children for failure even more so than stress in their own childhood. That's right, you heard that correctly. A mother's stress while the child is in the womb can be more detrimental to a child's development than the stress the child would experience in their own life. Which, chances are, if the pregnancy is really stressful, the child's life is probably going to be really stressful too, right? Maybe there's some financial issues going on. Maybe they're in an abusive relationship. Maybe they were raped, right? Maybe it was incestual. Who knows? All sorts of horrible shit. Again, none of our fucking business. Because, I mean, being shamed into having a baby against one's better judgment is stressful enough, okay? Being shamed into doing something you don't want to do, stressful enough. And that does not even take into account the many stressors that may have driven them to choose abortion in the first place. And there are a host of these stressors that can result in long-term issues for the child. And one of these also affects the rest of us. The situation where an abortion is chosen due to financial struggles. She can't afford to have the baby. Okay, shit happens. Mistakes happen. I got pregnant for one reason or another. None of our business, right? And now I want to have an abortion because, or not, maybe not want, bad word. Now I'm choosing to have an abortion because I can't afford the baby. Because a common objection from the pro-life side, at least in the U.S., and I've heard this, and I'm sure many of you have as well, they have an issue with the use of their tax dollars to pay for abortion procedures obtained through one government-funded source or another. Now, ignoring the fact that we all pay for tons of shit we don't necessarily support through our taxes, you know, like blowing up brown people in foreign countries, the logic is quite flawed for this particular expense, and I'll tell you why, dear listener. Because if a woman with insufficient resources ends up having a baby that she otherwise would have had aborted, and then goes on to raise it with financial support from the government. Seems like a likely situation, right? Can't afford the baby. You're making me have it. Okay, I've been guilted in having it. Can't afford this baby. What am I going to do? I'm going to go get government assistance. Well, that worst case, $3,000 or so medical bill, okay? That's about what an average abortion costs, $3,000, okay? We just paid for that out of our pocket. So that was divided up, all of us in the U.S., that $3,000. So we paid, you know, a millionth of a penny, whatever. So that medical bill for the abortion, that's, of course, that's ignoring the rare late-term procedure, which can cost into the realm of $15,000 for anybody out there saying, wait. Sure, I hear you, okay? But those rare late-term procedures are almost always paid for with private funds. They're almost never paid for with public funds. So now we would have paid, let's say, let's stick with the average, forgetting the late term, let's say our $3,000 bill that we're not paying. Okay, we're not paying $3,000 out of pocket. We're paying a percentage of that with our taxes, which is a very, 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 very small number for each of us individually. But anyway, well, that $3,000 now just skyrocketed to about $170,000. The average cost low-income parents spend to raise a child. So that's what we're paying now through this government assistance. It would have been $3,000. So you didn't want to pay for an abortion because you had an issue with it. Okay, that's my money. Well, your $3,000 you would have spent is now $170,000. Okay, that, in case you were wondering, is a bigger fucking number. So now, we taxpayers, instead of paying our $3,000, we get to foot the bill for almost $200,000 for raising the child on assistance in the situation where the mother cannot afford to raise the child on her own. And again, this is a very common reason many mothers seek an abortion in the first place. Now, sure, I'm sure some of you out there too are hollering and hooting and hollering and peeing your pants. Now, wait. She could put the child up for adoption. Sure, she could choose to put the child up for adoption. But then we're still footing the bill for delivery cost. Remember, she can't afford the child. Okay, she can't afford to raise the child. So she can't afford the $30,000 that most deliveries cost, right? Where does that come from? Guess what? That comes from us too. So that's 10 times more than we would have paid to have the abortion, okay? So your argument about not wanting to pay for abortions based on financial reasons is fucking bullshit and makes no sense, okay? So if a woman can't afford to have a child, she wants to have an abortion, we are always going to end up paying more. So in other words, if a woman who can't afford a child ends up having a baby for one reason or another against her better judgment because she's been pressured into it by religious people who are sticking their fucking nose where it doesn't belong, then the societal costs will always be higher than the cost of an abortion, financial and otherwise. And all of this comes back to the subjective beliefs of people who have absolutely fuck all to do with the decision itself, okay? None of our business, okay? Unless you're the one contemplating the abortion, it's none of your fucking business. And you know, I'm dropping a lot of F-bombs in this one because I get fired up about this topic. It's really upsetting to me when people stick their fucking noses where they don't belong. And real quick, one more thing. Before we move on, I do want to mention one other thing that is kind of relevant to this topic that is now going on in relation to the COVID pandemic, another kind of hot button topic for me, which is the appropriation of the phrase, my body, my choice, by those against wearing a mask or getting a vaccine. So people that don't want to wear a mask, don't want to get a vaccine, right? Now they're using the my body, my choice thing. We're going to set aside the irony of the fact that most of the jizz stains are on the pro-life side and are now using a phrase that the pro-choice side popularized. So I hate everything about you guys, but we're going to steal your phrase because we're unoriginal fucking cunts. And we're also going to set aside the irony of being pro-life, big air quotes there, while being perfectly okay with people dying so you don't have to get a sweaty upper lip or get pricked with a widow needle. I know it's very, very scary, but that's what you're doing. You're saying I'm pro-life, but I'm okay with 4 million fucking people die. I'm only pro-life when it fits my narrative, when it works with all my influences, right? So we're going to set aside those ridiculous fucking ironies for a minute, because I want to talk about the fundamental ridiculousness of using that phrase in the context of mask wearing. And it goes back to the argument about murder and why it's illegal, okay? Murder is illegal because of harmony, and because it can affect all of us. My body, my choice makes perfect sense for abortion because I cannot be aborted. Maybe I should have been. I'm sure many of you think I should have been, but I wasn't, and neither can you. And I'm sure many of you should have been aborted too, you shits, but you weren't. That ship, dear listener, has sailed. But as far as masks and vaccines go, I can get sick from COVID. And so can my kids, you fucking dickhead. And so can you. And we can spread it. So when people choose not to wear a mask because of their upper lip or get a vaccine because needles hurt, it has the potential to affect everyone. Okay? Everyone. When a woman has an abortion, it cannot affect anyone else except the fucking ball of cells that she's getting rid of. Okay, do you get it? I know you might not like it, but it still has nothing to do with you, okay? COVID does. COVID has a lot to do with you. Big difference, you fucking doofuses or doofy. I'm having trouble with the plurals today. COVID can affect everybody. So the my body, my choice argument is bullshit. Now, that's enough about abortion. Hopefully, it's a little clearer that unless one is contemplating an abortion of their own, they don't really get a say in the decision. And that expecting anyone to accommodate their own personal beliefs is a massive transgression in which subjective beliefs are being viewed as universal objective facts. Abortion is obviously a big one here, but another one where people love to interject their beliefs into the lives of others is same-sex marriage. Now, I won't go into detail on that one now because the punchline is about the same. Unless it's your own marriage you're contemplating, fuck off, okay? If someone else's marriage somehow devalues the sanctity of your own, you need to take a look inward and try to determine exactly what is missing in your own sad, sad life to have such a ridiculous viewpoint on people that have nothing to do with you. Okay, moving on. We've established that confusing our subjective viewpoints as objective ones is one major potential downside of religion. Okay, that's a really, really big one, probably the biggest. Another one is the suspension of rational thinking that is required to believe many of the stories and teachings of the world's religions. Let's be clear that suspension of rational thinking in service to religious beliefs does not necessarily result in detriments to us, the individual. Plenty of people out there hold the viewpoints that Noah and the Ark, Jonah and the whale, and all these other fantastical tales from religious texts are accurate. Yes, they do. Historical accounts, and that these people continue to go about their days just fine. They do. They believe it, and they're probably going about their days just fine. I assume, maybe. The problem, again, is when this type of thinking carries over into the realm of objective reality. The specific issue where this has far-reaching effects is conspiracy theories. Because our willingness to forego rationality in favor of what we want to be true in a religious context makes us susceptible to the same process in our lives outside of religion. Indeed, dear listener, research has shown that those who identify as religious are more receptive to lies, to misinformation, and ultimately to belief in conspiracy theories and other things not based on reality. Makes sense. If you're going to forego reality and critical thinking for one thing, it makes it easier to do it for others. And a big reason for this is that conspiracy theories are in and of themselves a form of magical and irrational thinking, used to explain randomness or coincidence where no connection exists. The religious mindset contends that random or coincidental events happen for a reason. Of course, it's often the preferred deity's reason. And this desire for a definitive cause and effect relationship is then extended to the happenings in the world, resulting in a higher likelihood of belief in conspiracy theories and the like. For example, just, you know, throwing this one out there, let's consider an election loss of one's preferred candidate. The belief that this candidate was chosen by our preferred deity means that they must win the election for the world to continue making sense. They have to. But when they lose, their loss creates a perceived misalignment between cause and effect, which our good old friend cognitive dissonance, that enabler, it does not like it. So we, wanting that not to be there, we don't want to experience cognitive dissonance. It's uncomfortable, and we don't like discomfort. We seek out ways to make sense of the situation. Confirmation bias is often involved too, since we have a specific end we're working toward, said end being supporting evidence for election fraud. And confirmation bias also helps us ignore the contradictory big-ass elephant in the room, which is that an all-powerful deity should have been able to prevent election fraud if that deity desired it, right? Or at least mitigate it such that it wouldn't have changed the outcome, right? Why, if this all-powerful deity wanted Trump, for instance, to remain president, why didn't he just go ahead, or she, whatever it, why didn't this deity just go ahead and do it? Because influences and enablers are powerful little shits. That would make our predetermined narrative not work anymore. Something to consider. Now, I chose the election example because, aside from the fact that it's happening as I record this, still, it's still fucking happening regarding Donald Trump's very, very definitive election loss. Another factor that contributes towards one's potential to engage in conspiracy theories is when one feels anxious, disenfranchised, or when one's values are not being preserved. Well, the loss of a preferred candidate can trigger all of those feelings. And then it creates a double whammy for potential indulgence in conspiracy theory thinking when it's combined with religious tendencies. And this matters. For elections, it sows doubt in the voting process. For vaccines, it has public health concerns. A lot of people that voted for Trump and continue to support Trump and are of a religious mindset are not getting the vaccines. That is a very political thing right now. And there's a big public health concern when you don't get them. Because there are real and widespread consequences to magical thinking being applied outside of a religious context. So that is why it's not a good thing when we forget the subjectivity of our religious thinking and apply it elsewhere. Because people die when religious thinking ventures into extreme thinking and reality. You guys remember 9/11? Was that driven by rational thinking? I don't think it was, but I can tell you what it was driven by, and I think you know too, okay? Now, we may not all be falling victim to conspiracy theories as a result of our religion, but what about when we just use magical thinking as a blanket justification for things we don't readily understand or want to accept? It's not exactly the same thing, but it's kind of in the same vein. A child dies of cancer. We say God has a plan. Well, if that makes us feel better and helps us to internally process the feelings, then the detriments are probably minimal. But what about when we externalize it and use it to shirk our individual responsibility? Let's say we fail at a new business. It was God's plan. We're just going to assume it's God's will. We're going to give up. Perhaps we'd be better served by analyzing what happened to see if we can do some things differently and then improve our chances of success. Maybe we could do it instead of worrying about God doing it. Let's say we blow a client meeting and we blame it on the devil for attacking us, that motherfucker. Well, maybe we could have been better prepared. Let's try and get a second meeting, give it another shot, okay? Maybe the devil will sit this one out. How about when we give the benefit of the doubt to supernatural thinking over objective scientific evidence? Evolution is a perfect example. Many just blow off the whole concept of evolution in favor of creationism. Yet, there are many others who are somewhere in the middle. They believe something to the tune of, I accept the reality of evolution. There's just too much evidence not to, okay? But I also believe in a God or gods. So it must have been designed. Evolution must have been designed and put into motion by this God or gods, okay? Well, okay, I hear you. But if that is the case, not only does that run directly opposite to the origin stories of every major religion on Earth, but it isn't mentioned in any of their texts either. Nowhere in there does God talk about this, to say, hey, this is how we all came about, okay? And moreover, why would an all-powerful being utilize a process based on chance and randomness when they could have just designed an ideal being from the get-go? It doesn't make a lot of sense, okay? Why do this? Why start with a single-celled organism and work all the way up to us talking, masturbating apes? Why? It seems kind of roundabout, especially when you consider how non-ideal our human design really is. Intelligent design, fucking please. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard of these. Have you ever heard of vestigial structures? Okay. These are essentially the useless parts of our body that we have now that tagged along for some clearly non-intelligent reason during evolution. One of them is our appendix. And I doubt many who've had theirs removed would consider its inclusion in our body intelligent. That goes double for anyone who's had theirs burst, assuming they're still alive. Our tailbone is another one. You know, the fused remnants of our ancestral tails. That is why we have a tailbone, folks. Sorry, we used to have tails. Yes, we can. It made it easier to swing around from the trees, okay? The scientific name is coccyx, which sounds a lot like cock sucks, a designation you may find fitting if, like me, you've ever broken yours. Yeah, I broke mine snowboarding about 15 years ago. And to this day, 22 years later, I can't sit on a hard chair for longer than about an hour before it feels like I've broken it all over again. So about the time I finished a recording, you know, when my voice is toast and freaking feet are asleep and all that other shit that happens, yeah, my ass hurts too. So what, I'm coming up on 40 minutes in here. Yeah, my ass hurts. In case you want to know, now you know. Any male listeners ever get runner's nipple? Yeah, that's, or anybody really. That's a pleasant experience, isn't it? Yeah, well, guess what? Unless you plan on lactating, you don't need those nipples either, friends. So I've carried these nipples around my whole life, and I've scraped them on the bottom of a pool. Have you ever done that? The worst thing you're ever going to experience. And I've had bloody nipples from running. Horrible. Don't need them. Yep. But why are they there? I don't know. Not fucking intelligent, I can tell you that. See, now, you religious folks, you're not the only ones who talk to people in your head or hear people talking to you in your head, because I can hear something, and I think it's some of you singing something to the tune of, but what if there is intent to evolution, and it's just too complex for our feeble little human minds to understand? I think we can all agree that most of the stories in the religions, creation included, they're all metaphors and not meant to be taken literally. Okay, to that, I would respond with something to the effect of, well, my sore ass and bloody nipples beg to differ regarding evolution's intent or its intelligence, but we'll let that part go for now. The part I want to dig into and agree with you on wholeheartedly is the metaphorical bit, because I do agree with you. And I also agree that all of the supernatural stories told in all of the world's religious texts are meant to be exactly that, and meant to be interpreted as exactly that, metaphors and analogies. But to this, though, okay, I have a follow-up question, right? We're not going to take these stories literally. That makes sense. If we were to take them literally, we would have to suspend reality quite far to buy into something like Noah or Jonah and the whale or all the other fucking things, walking on water, all that shit. Part in the sea, earth being made in 6 days, we know that's not true. So if we treat certain stories from religion as metaphors, how do we know which stories are metaphors and which are not? So for instance, if we're not amongst those who subscribe to a literal interpretation of Noah's tale, because we understand that the animals and Noah's family would have almost certainly died out due to inbreeding and the consequent lack of genetic diversity, how can we then interpret the other tales literally, right? How can we just pick and choose which one? Well, that one's not quite as fantastical as the other. Why are they all in the same book then? Why is there not a disclaimer saying which ones are less realistic than the other? Well, subjective preference is the only answer. Because once we relegate one story to the realm of impossibility, all of them should be subject to the same scrutiny, not just those that can be disproved scientifically. So keeping with that logic, couldn't every single one of the stories be metaphors, all the way up to the existence of the deities themselves? So if it's all a metaphor, couldn't they be a metaphor too? Something to just kind of keep us toeing that line? Because if not, we're still going back to picking and choosing which ones we like to fit our preferred narrative. Anyway, something to think about. Please do. Just please give it some consideration, because just like magical thinking in general, it's worth considering where we draw the line on where religion ends and reality begins. And so that, with that, we've just about covered all the pitfalls I wanted to discuss as regards to religion. And once more, these primarily stem from our forgetting of religion's subjective nature, its essential subjective nature. Now, the one we didn't touch on too much, I did a little bit, was extreme behavior like terrorism. But I'm working off the assumption that the people on the part of the religious spectrum that are getting down on terrorism aren't really interested in podcasts or programs about improving one's overall well-being through clean thinking. But if I'm wrong, welcome, new friends. And now, I'm sure you're loving what I have to say. And now that we've covered these pitfalls, let's go ahead and see how we might work through a couple of examples using our old friend, the Immaculate Process. So for any new listeners, the Immaculate Process, it is an acronym, which I can't really remember, something about clean thinking. This acronym, this Immaculate Process, it's how we apply the concept of clean thinking to our everyday lives. And our first example deals with the topic of same-sex marriage that we touched on briefly just a bit ago. And for this example, we're going to imagine that we are heterosexual members of a given Christian denomination who are vehemently opposed to same-sex marriage because it has everything to do with us. So let's go through the process. Do we know why we're opposed to same-sex marriage? Well, yes, of course. We oppose same-sex marriage because it violates the sanctity of marriage as established by God, who has defined it as a union between a man and a woman. Okay, fair enough. We don't need to go any further here with our understanding of our reason why. We are devout and we believe the word of God is the final word. That's enough. Now, we could always benefit, of course, from the insight gained if we were to investigate the reasons why we're religious in the first place or why we indulge in certain beliefs and not others. But for this exercise, it is not necessary. Instead, we're going to move on to the next part of the process and determine if this is serving us. Is our opposition to same-sex marriage serving us? No, it is not serving us because we are taking our subjective viewpoints and treating them as objective. The maintenance of these viewpoints creates internal strife and conflict in our mind, on which we are spending mental resources and effort that could be better utilized on our family or our own personal growth. And it is also marginalizing a group of people whose actions have once again nothing to do with our own subjective viewpoints. And critically, that marginalization has led to multiple instances of violence against the gay community. So there are legitimate repercussions from disseminating the viewpoint that same-sex marriage couples are somehow at odds with God, our subjective God, somebody else is at odds with. Seriously? But even if we cannot perform the very difficult task of fully accepting our religious views as subjective, it is important to understand that they are individual and not shared by all, remember? Furthermore, we should recognize the reality that we are picking and choosing from the Bible to support one view while ignoring many, many others when we're doing this, okay? Now, if we use Leviticus 20:13 as biblical justification for our stance against same-sex marriage, then we should, by rights, jump back just three verses, okay? Just three verses to Leviticus 20:10, which says that adulterers should be put to death. Huh, okay. Cheat on your wife, cheat on your husband, you're toast. And perhaps if we're going to do that, we should start with certain crusaders for the family, like Newt Gingrich, famously cheated on his dying wife. I think she had cancer. Hell of a guy, right? Oh, good old Newt. Yeah, remember when he just tried to destroy Bill Clinton for the cigar and Monica Lewinsky shit? While he was banging somebody else while his wife was dying. What a fucking douchebag. Or how about Jerry Falwell Jr.? Now, is it still considered adultery since he was consenting when he watched his wife get down with the pool boy? Whew, I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of things in the Bible we could find that don't agree with that. What about Bob Coy or Bill Gothard or all of these other motherfuckers who are Christian crusaders and all against gay marriage and all against this, who are horrible, horrible people cheating on their wives, doing all sorts of nasty shit? The point is that picking and choosing what supports our views while ignoring that what doesn't, not just in the same book, but in the same fucking chapter, that is confirmation bias and subjective thinking exemplified. Because what we're doing is we're applying subjective thinking methods to an already subjective source. Okay, that's a double whammy of subjectivity. We'd almost have to go out of our way to arrive at a conclusion outside of the one that we're already aiming for. Okay? So the question then becomes, how do we handle a subjective viewpoint that is not serving us? But, okay, we're going to take a real quick aside, because even before we consider that, let's remember that we also should consider those to whom we're responsible when making determinations that could affect them, okay? Could this one? Yeah, it absolutely does. Is it serving them? Well, what if one of our children comes out as gay? Are we going to support them as we ought to as good parents? Or do we ostracize them for something they did not choose, based on a system of belief that we did choose? We chose these beliefs. They did not choose to be gay. What do we do? Do we do the right thing, or do we send them to one of those barbarous abominations called fucking conversion camps? I think this simple act of contemplating that scenario should give us our answer, but maybe some of us don't have children or ever intend to. But if not, you can apply it to anyone in your lives who you care about. And if you don't care about anybody, just fucking stay out of other people's business anyway. That would be great. Because if none of that works, the fact is, we ultimately must acknowledge and accept the subjective nature of our views in order to achieve clean thinking and optimize our minds, because that's our goal here. We can maintain whatever personal views we damn well choose, no matter how ill-advised for our own mental well-being they may be. But we need to remember that they are indeed personal and do not have jurisdiction over the actions or the lives of others. Like I said earlier, if our marriage or our view of marriage is so fragile that what other people do in their private lives can taint our own marriage, then we need to turn the attention on ourselves and get to the root of that shit, because this shit's all on us. It has nothing to do with Adam and Steve. And if that is indeed the case, that our own marriage feels tainted because of other people's marriage, then the Clean Thinkers is here. I am here to help you get to the bottom of it and fucking straighten that shit out. Okay, and there's the shameless sales pitch you've been waiting for. Now, it took a little longer than usual, but, you know, I had to throw it in there. I had to whine at the beginning about how hard it is to move and all that stuff. That's all I have for this particular example. But I do want to note one interesting point before we move on to the next one. Because since it wasn't required to complete the Immaculate Process for this topic, and given that we're focused on whether or not our viewpoint is serving us, we didn't dig into our root why earlier, our reason for opposing same-sex marriage in the first place. But it is worth giving it some thought now. So the answer I used for our why in the example, it was the violation of the sanctity of marriage, I appropriated that from a few different Christian sources, so all of which they had a fairly consistent message as to why they oppose same-sex marriage, which pretty much comes back to the fact that it somehow affects their marriage and or God's view of it, whatever. But of course, me being an objective person, I naturally looked into the objective research to get a scientific perspective into the roots as well. And as always, I cited this specific research in the show notes, so you can go have a look at it. And now it's worth noting, based on the type of research that was done, that any survey-based data, which this was, it comes with some inherent flaws and biases by nature. That's surveys, okay? But the fairly large sample size and the use of statistical methods, they make the information from this peer-reviewed study, yes, it was published in a scientific journal, it makes this information about as objective as can be reasonably expected from a compilation of what are pretty much subjective answers. In the data from said study, the data indicate that the primary drivers of a person's opposition to same-sex marriage are one's desire to maintain the status quo, or traditional conservative values, and one's prejudice against those with different sexual orientations. In other words, religious beliefs aren't really the root why, but instead are being used like an influence enabler to justify underlying prejudices and preferences. As we've noted several times before, hint, hint, understanding our root whys can provide beneficial insights into our thinking that can help facilitate our journey to clean thinking, even if it's not required to complete the process for a given concept. Because remember, the Immaculate Process is supposed to be able to be usable during our day-to-day activities, our day-to-day lives, to help us make better choices. So we can't really be taking the time to sit back and contemplate our deepest root whys for every choice and every thought. But we're going to talk about it now, because the sexual prejudice driver of same-sex marriage opposition is one of those very useful whys. Because you may recall back in episode 9, remember that was about our past experience influence, when we discussed how our brains, they like to use generalizations to make sense of the abundance of information available to us at any given time. So we described some of the potential detriments that come about when this process is left to run unchecked. We described them at the time, but we didn't explicitly name them as prejudices, although that's exactly what they are. When we overgeneralize, that becomes prejudice. Because it turns out religious thinking is indeed linked with one's desire to avoid the unknown and said discomfort with uncertainty and ambiguity. And that is itself correlated with one's tendency towards prejudices. Now, I'm not claiming that religion causes prejudice or vice versa, but the data clearly indicate a connection, meaning it's correlative, even if it's not always causal. So they are related. The clean thinker's contention, okay, now this is our speculation based on all of our evidence and work that we've done, is that the nature of the relationship between religions and prejudice is the just so expectation of many religious teachings and people who practice them. Things must be this way or they are wrong. Action A is either virtuous or sinful. Person A either fits the mold and is part of the group, or they don't and they are excluded from it. And that just so expectation, just so, thank you, happens to form the core of our next example, which deals with self-doubt. Because self-doubt is something that just about everyone deals with at some point or another. Even the highest performing individuals out there experience it from time to time through imposter syndrome. And really, the only people who don't seem to experience self-doubt from time to time are psychopaths. And since they represent only about 1% of the population, chances are high that most of you, dear listeners, are free from that particular malady. Though then again, I wouldn't be all that surprised if people of that disposition were drawn to my podcast more so than others. But anyway, this next example deals with two different ways that self-doubt relates to religious affiliation. The first is how religion can contribute to the occurrence of self-doubt in the first place. Although a positive self-image is often associated with religion, recent research suggests that this benefit is primarily gleaned from the positive feelings we experience by being included and by fitting in with the group. Self-doubt is a whole different animal from self-image. It can actually be enhanced by religious association through our desire to meet and exceed what amount to terms and conditions of membership, right? We have these expectations that we have to meet for God, but how can we ever be good enough in the face of God's expectations or the church's, or against the expectations we put on ourselves to be the ideal family or the ideal Christian? It's a lot to live up to, and it can make us feel like big, worthless turds when we don't. The second way that self-doubt relates to religious affiliation is when we allow self-doubt to affect our decision-making. Having deemed ourselves unworthy in the face of nearly insurmountable expectations, it's perfectly reasonable to assume we're incapable of making the best decisions for ourselves or our family. And instead, we just simply throw up our hands in defeat and give it to God. Well, in doing so, we've taken the responsibility off of our own plate and used our beliefs as a scapegoat to avoid the potential reinforcement of our self-doubt that failure would provide. So in this example, which is actually based on a real-life scenario I observed someone experience, let's again imagine that we are devout Christians. Though any monotheistic denomination will do, but let's just go with Christians, okay? And let's also imagine that we have an aging mother who is slowly deteriorating into senility and has just about reached the point where she will be incapable of living alone. So we're of the mind that we have an obligation to take care of her, but we can't afford to pay for an assisted living facility of the caliber we'd prefer. And we can't swing the cost for the round-the-clock care she'd require at home. And we really don't want her living in our home, right? As bad as that might sound, but at the same time, she doesn't really want to live with us either. We both like things just so, remember? So what do we do? Well, we ponder the situation, become exasperated when we're unable to come up with an immediate answer, and then, of course, we succumb to our self-doubt. There's no mutually convenient or satisfactory answer to be found, and we're at a loss as to what we should do. So what do? We decide to give it to God. Mom's on board with that approach, too, since she was the one who got us into religion in the first place. We think of ourselves as pretty righteous, but compared with her, we look a little bit more like Caligula. However, unlike Caligula, we did not die young and are still kicking. Mom, on the other hand, slipped and fell while we were waffling, broke her hip, and had to be hospitalized. I apologize for using yet another morbid and macabre story, and it's a wonder I have any family left to speak of, but while in the hospital, Mom caught an infection and passed away. Oh, maybe Caligula's nephew Nero would have been a more fitting descriptor for us. At any rate, you know what's next. Let's go through our old friend, the Immaculate Process. We probably should have done it before Mom died, but we're going to do it now in retrospect. So, do we know why we killed our mother? Relax, I'm kidding. Kind of. But let's proceed in earnest. We'll rephrase it as, do we know why we shirked our responsibility to make a decision? Yes, of course we do. Our continued failure to meet the impossible standards we've placed on ourselves has allowed crippling self-doubt to worm its way into our day-to-day decision-making process, whether those decisions are mundane or momentous. Is it serving us? Okay, let's move on. We know our why. Now let's ask ourselves, is it serving us to saddle the figurehead of our subjective belief system with our responsibilities? No, it's not serving us. It is doing quite the opposite. Sure, Mom may have slipped and fallen at our house too, and the end result may have been the same, but we don't know. And not knowing is going to tear at us for the rest of our lives. And, I mean, we can double down on dodging our responsibility by writing off what happened as just another part of God's plan. But deep down, we know that's a cop-out and not serving us. So whether we're of the mind that critical thinking and free will are evolved or they're divinely granted, we had the tools at our disposal to make a choice, and we chose not to use those tools. We committed the cardinal sin of clean thinking by treating our subjective beliefs as objective fact through the assumption that a higher power would just swoop in and take action on our behalf. And because of that, there were real definitive repercussions. And the essence of that last line, dear listener, is what I hope we all take away from this episode more than anything else, okay? No matter how vital religion is to our lives or our identity, it is a subjective influence. It's a subjective thing. It's a belief. It's individual. Because of that, it can either be a benefit or a detriment, depending on how we utilize it. When it's recognized as a subjective and individual belief that is being used to improve the well-being of those to whom we're responsible, ourselves and the rest of the world, then we're on the path to clean thinking and our religion is fitting in with our lives perfectly. Everything's working well. But when we treat our religion as objective fact, and then we use it to marginalize and attack people who are different than us, LGBTQ people, people of different races, creeds, or even religions, poor people, rich people, or anyone who doesn't align with our just-so expectations of behavior, just-so expectations of what people should be, then we are engaged in dirty thinking of the unfucking holiest kind, which ultimately promotes strife and conflict within ourselves, within our family, and with our friends. And, you know, I'm confident that all of us, we have the ability to evolve our own thinking about our religion such that we can ensure we understand its subjectivity, and such that at the same time, we can still ensure it's serving us and those to whom we're responsible, still get all the benefits out of it without afflicting us with the potential detriments of which we just discussed, because they are there, but they don't have to be. And one of the big reasons why I'm confident that we can do this is because of how I have been able to evolve my own views on religion. Because I used to have a very, 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 very negative view of religion, okay? For me, you said religion, I thought cesspool of negativity and bad shit, nothing but backwards thinking, judgmentalism, terrorism, child molestation, all of it. That's all I could see. I couldn't see the good, because there is good. There's good for people. I still prefer people to take an internal focus, but if you need to use a proxy and the proxy works and you're doing the right things and you're not hurting others, you're not judging others, you're not inserting yourself in other people's lives, but you're getting the benefit out of it, great. But when all the other bad shit that I talked about and all the other stuff that we haven't talked about, but you know what they are, when that stuff starts to happen, then it's bad, okay? Because I came to the realization, the way I was able to come to this realization was that I realized my own viewpoint was largely subjective. Because I had erroneously applied all of the negatives about religion, because those are objective. Those negative things objectively happen. But the subjective part was that I applied it to everything. I just said religion was bad across the board, and that's not true. Because there is a lot of good to be extracted, until there isn't. And that line between good and not good comes down to recognizing what is objective and what isn't, okay? Understanding the nature of our beliefs and getting the good out of it, leaving behind the bad, okay? And with that, this is a long one, we're pretty much wrapped up with this episode of the Dirty Thoughts Let's Talk podcast, brought to you by the Clean Thinkers, episode number 14. And once more, I genuinely appreciate you being here with me and the rest of the Clean Thinkers community. Now, as always, please, please check out the show notes for citations to all the information we referenced in the podcast. You can learn a little bit. I can't always get full access to full text articles, but I try and find articles that people can just go ahead and read. You can't just see an excerpt or the abstract. You can look at the whole thing, because there's a lot to be learned out there. And I cited quite a few articles for this one. Remember, our next episode is not going to be released next week. It's going to be in 2 weeks, because that's our new format. Every other week, we will release an episode. And in our next episode, that'll come out on August 22nd, we're going to focus on August's monthly theme, which is our authentic self. And that is all about recognizing and accepting who we are, no matter how weird that self might be, okay? It's going to be a feel-good episode. We can all just start talking about who we are and all the weirdness that comes along with that. So please, please stop back in a couple of weeks, okay? Take care. I look forward to speaking with you then.